Okay, so I think we may start this session. My name is Petr Pajas. I will talk about an XML-based format that we use to represent the PDT annotation layers. I hope that it won't be too technical for people who are linguists or computational linguists. This is our agenda. I will, after some introduction, I will overview the basic features of the data format that we use. Then we'll go in depth into data types and roles, which are concepts that I will introduce. Then I will show how the analytical layer is actually represented in that format. It will be an example. All the other layers are represented similarly. And then I will show you how internally the annotation layers can be merged in the lower three layers can be merged into one single representation. And after some final remarks, there will be a place for questions. As you may have learned today and yesterday, PDT has several interlinked annotation layers. And basically, there are two types of annotations. The lower two layers are sequential, linear, and the upper two layers are tree structured. So there's linearity and structure. We also use the same concept of layering for other languages, not just for Czech. So we have Prague Arabic Tree Bank, Prague English Tree Bank, and people from other countries also sometimes adopt our annotation structure. Also, for specific projects, people use variants of our annotation schemes and of the formats that we use. And so what we try to do is to make it easier for them to change little things in our annotation schema. Some of the annotation layers, specifically morphological layer and tectogrammatic layer, are related to something that we call annotation dictionaries or annotation lexicons. So beside data, we also have some static, beside the annotation, we also have some static information stored in lexicons. What we wanted to do when we started our work on the format for PDT 2.0 was to find a representation that would fit all these things at the same time and that would represent similar things in a similar way. So we wanted some kind of uniformity of the representation. So that means that because there are various different kinds of data in the tree bank, that means that we actually need something more like a meta format, not specific format, but something more general than that. And some common ground from which we can derive specific formats for the specific annotation layers, dictionaries, etc. Well, actually XML is a language that is best known for being a great meta format. You can encode almost everything quite nicely in XML, but because of its generic nature, it is probably too generic to assure uniformity. Different people may choose different approach to represent the same data structure in XML. So we wanted something that is more strict to ensure uniformity of representation. So we need something that is in between XML, which is the general, and the specific, which are the specific data formats that are used for the specific annotation layers, annotation dictionaries, annotation projects, etc. So we started designing a meta format, and here are some requirements that we had for that format. The first one was uniformity of representation, which basically means that when things are similar or analogous, we want to represent them in the same way or similar way. The standoff principles are also incorporated, so we wish to be able to separate the annotation layers from one another and to separate the annotations from the original data. Because of the separation of data and annotation layers, and because of the existence of lexicons, there are lots of links between the annotation, between the data, either cross-references, links between layers, and links to external documents. So we also wished that there would be some uniform representation of these relations. And we kept in mind that we want to be able to represent sequential data and structured data. Because our annotation is really rich, we wanted to be able to encode in the format something at least as powerful as our feature structures. During the annotation process, people usually have to deal with some sort of ambiguity, and the ambiguities can be on any level, and we also wished to encode into the format these ambiguities in a uniform manner. When designing a data format that will be used by applications, we should not forget about human readability, because especially in the first phases of the development, you have to deal with the data by hand sometimes. If in no other cases than in emergency situations when your tool breaks the data and you have to fix it, you don't want to lose your data because you made a bug in your tool. So human readability is a good thing to have. And of course, when I told that different projects adopt our annotation schema, our format, they usually want to extend or remove something, but extend, replace it with something else, etc. So extensibility is also important. And we have from the beginning decided to do this all in XML, because XML is widely deployed, widely recognized data format. And there are many existing tools that deal with it. So as I said, the format should be more like a meta format, and from which the specific formats are to be derived. And when you derive for a new specific format, you should do that formally in some description language. So we need some description language that would allow us to define the specific formats. Here is a diagram of what's going on. So we have XML. This is our basis. We base on XML, and PML is derived from XML by its specification. And whenever you have some annotation schema for some particular layer and you want to encode data in PML according to your annotation schema, you formalize the abstract content, the abstract concept of annotation schema into a file that we call PML schema. And PML schema uniquely defines a PML format, a specific format that you can use in your annotation then. I will explain this in more detail now. So in PDT, we have a different specific format for each annotation layer, but all these are described uniformly using PML schemas. And PML schema is the description language that I was talking about, and it sort of also formalizes the abstract concept of annotation schema for the particular layer of annotation. It does that by defining the data structure, the annotation structure of the annotation layer, and by assigning something that we call PML roles to the data types PML roles introduce into the data some relational structure that crosses the boundaries of nesting data types. So annotation structure, by that I mean actually the data types. There are the structure is built from abstract data types that are basically either atomic values, strings, integers, but then also some complex structures like attribute value structures, lists, alternatives, etc. And roles are some labels that we can assign to any piece of to some pieces of data and indicate that this piece of data carries some relational information. The details will follow. And a document that confirms to a PML schema is referred to as a PML instance, and it's actually, these are the data, those are the files that you find in PDT. Because PML is based on XML, there are many ways in which you can process PML. You can do it by conventional XML-oriented tools. You don't have to care about PML if you don't want to. You simply parse them as an XML file using your XML parser and use XPath to query that data, use XSLT to transform them, etc. You can also, if you know that you are, if you are working on a tool that deals with a specific annotation layer, you may also hardwire the information that would otherwise be retrieved from PML schema into the code of your application. But the best way, or the most recommended way, is to actually use the information that is stored in PML schema in order to find an optimal in-memory representation for the data and to create the relations that are available due to the or thanks to the role assignment that are that is included in the PML schema. If you wish to merely validate your PML instances, then the way to do it is to take your PML schema and translate it via XSLT. There is a style sheet available for that. Into a RelaxNG schema. A RelaxNG is a language designed specifically for validating XML documents. So then you can use conventional tools to validate the instances. Now we go in depth into the concepts that are behind PML. First we start with data types. There are two groups of data types. The first are atomic. There are the actual values. There are the actual data, in fact. And those are either character-based data, simply strings, or enumerated values from some finite set of predefined values. Or we also have a constant type. And then there are complex data types that that group these atomic types into more complex structures. So I'll start with the atomic data types. The most generic one is C data type. C data are plain, are just strings actually, character-based content. They have no explicitly marked structure, but what you can do is that you can specify some restriction on the format of the string. So you may say that the string actually should be formatted as a date or as an integer number, etc. PML adopted almost all the W3C schema simple data types for that. So if something is good on W3C schema language, it is the simple types. And on the bottom of the slide, you see on the left-hand side a declaration that is the PML schema, and on the right-hand side you see an example of the actual data. Enumerated data types are data types with a predefined finite set of possible values. So the value space for that data is finite, and you list all the values as shown at the top of the slide. So on the left again is the declaration, and on the right there is a possible instance. A constant type is a bit similar. You specify the one, precisely one value, and actually in the data you don't have to, usually you don't have to specify the value because the value is constant, so it is implied by the schema. But the actual use cases for that are limited, and I will probably show you one later. Now, to the complex types. Complex types are used to aggregate the atomic values and other complex types. The most generic complex type that we have in PML is something that we call an AVS, which is an attribute value structure, or shortly a structure. It consists of a finite set of attribute value pairs where the attributes are named, and the structure contains, for each of the attributes, the name of the attribute uniquely determines the attribute in the structure. The values of the attributes may be either atomic or complex. So you can have nested structures so that you have something that is available in feature structures immediately. We refer to these pairs, the attribute value pairs, as members of the structure. It is just a terminology thing. A member of a structure can be either optional or required, and you may choose to render some atomic valued member as an XML attribute. Here are some examples. On the left, again, is a declaration as it appears in a PML schema, and on the right-hand side, there are example instances. So you see that this structure has actually four members. The first member is an ID, which is rendered as an attribute of the element containing the structure. And it is given the role ID. I think there is an error in your in the printed version. The role should be on the member, not on the C data. I think there's a typo in there. The role says that this member carries actually the identifier of the whole structure. The other two members are form and lemma, and they are also atomic valued, and they carry tokens. And of these two, form is required. Actually, of these four attributes, only four form is required. And there's a fourth member named tag, and we do not list its type declaration here, but it is declared somewhere else in the schema, and we only refer to that type by its name. So there should be probably some enumerated type that would be named like text set type. So that's about it. So you see that the members are either represented as attributes or as elements whose names are the names of the members, and content is the content of the data type. Containers are complex data types that look a bit similar to structures, but they're used for annotating one central value with a finite set of named values, named value attributes. So you have some central value. Here in this case, it's a token, and what the data type does is that it attaches to this value some other some labels, some attributes, they again have a name and type and may carry a role. Now, we found in our data many places where we need to aggregate more values of the same type into one complex data structure, and lists are particularly designed for that. Lists aggregate zero or more values of the same data type. You can declare a list as ordered list or an ordered list, which simply states that the application should preserve the order in case that the list is declared as ordered. We use a reserved tag LM to separate the individual values in the list, and we have something that is called list folding, which allows you, in case that the list contains only one singleton value, it allows you to skip the LM tag, so you can encode a singleton list like this as well. It looks a bit weird, but I will show you that it is actually quite useful in some cases, at least. Similarly, one needs to aggregate values if there is a need for representation of ambiguity or for a need for representing alternative annotations. And we use a data type called alternative for that, and a reserved tag AM to separate the individual values. Again, as with lists, the singleton AM can be omitted. So we have also alternative folding here. The basic difference between alternatives and lists, although they look similar in the instance, is semantical. When you have lists, list value consists of all the individual values as a one thing. So you have, for example, a list of words that forms a sentence, but alternatives are sort of parallel values to one slot. So you may have alternatives meanings of one word, but not a list of meanings particularly ordered. So actually, whenever you assign an alternative to some piece of data, you sort of narrowing the value space into the finite set of values that you have listed. Whereas if you assign a single value, you have narrowed it to one specific value. Similar to lists are sequences. I said that lists aggregate values of the same type. If you wish to aggregate values that may vary in type, in the data type, then you use sequences. Sequences consists of zero or more named value pairs, but unlike in structures, the names may repeat in a sequence. And for each of these pairs, which we call elements, you declare its name and its data type again in the PML schema declaration. And you can also restrict the ordering of the elements in the sequence using a regular expression like pattern. Now, a few words about PML roles. I said the PML roles provide some ways to introduce relational stuff into these data typing structures. So here are the roles that we use in PDT, and potentially there will be more roles added once PML is applied to other projects and purposes. So we have a role ID that we use to identify the member or attribute of some construction that carries its unique identifier. We use finally named role NIT, which we use to indicate that a certain link between two annotation layers is suitable for merging, as a merging place for these annotation layers. So it indicates that you can actually take the value that you refer to and embed it in place of the link. We use a set of roles to represent the tree relation in the data structure. So we have a role named trees, which indicates that a certain list contains the trees. For each structure that should be considered a node in a tree, we have a role node, and such a structure should contain one member that has the role child nodes and carries all the child nodes of the node. And we also have, because the trees in PDT are ordered, so we have a label, a role that labels the member that carries the ordering attribute. As for links in PDT, in PML format, we currently only, the specification currently only dictates the way you should do links that are ID based. So links usually, these links usually work between PML schemas or from PML, between PML and PML data formats, or from PML to XML in general. If there is a need to represent other types of links, it can be done, but on so far only on per application basis. I will show an example. So there are basically two types of ID-based links. One are links that are just cross-references within one file. And in that case, all you need is to assign unique identifier to the object you are referring to and state this same identifier in the link. But we also have links to other instances, and in that case, the link should indicate which file the target object is located in and then specify the ID of the target object. But as it happens in PDT specifically, there are actually many links from one file to only few files. There are like thousands links to only few files. So it would be quite impractical to repeat the file name of the target file with every link. So what we do is that we declare a symbolic name for the target file and use this symbolic name to instead of the file name to refer to the target file. I will show you how it works in a moment. So in a PML instance, you have a header which can assign unique IDs to all the external resources that you will further in the instance refer to. So here, for example, we have an ID A assigned to a document doc73.a and the identifier V to this URL. And later, when we create links, then these links are either simply cross-references, in which case we only mention the ID of the target object, or if the link goes to some external resources, some external resource, we instead of repeating this URL, we simply use this identifier V. And then we may follow it by the ID of the target object. The same applies to A. And here is an example of a link that points to two objects in the file .73A. As for non-ID based links, for example, if you have audio data that you wish to link into, you can use the same way to create shortcuts for the file name and then define your own way to refer to some piece of information contained in the file, either on the time basis or whatever the actual format is. But we actually do plan to specify some common representation for various media types and the way to link into them. Now I will say a few words about how PML is actually extendable. The most usual case is that you have some PML schema and suddenly contain somewhere a declaration for an analytical function that could carry one C data value. And during the annotation, you decide that you have to deal, in some cases, with ambiguity and that you need to be able to put more than one value so you don't restrict the value space into one particular value, but into a finite set of values. And the only thing that you have to do is to wrap the declaration in the PML schema into the alt tag, because your current data may be kept untouched because of the alternative folding, because this value can also be understood as a singleton, as a representation of a singleton alternative. And then whenever you need, you can use ambiguity. The same applies to lists. So, for example, if you have two annotation layers that you first assumed that to be interlinked in a one-to-one manner, and then for some reason you find out that the relation actually is one-to-many, then it is very easy to extend your PML schema. You simply add this instruction there, and it says that all these links could take more than one values, like here. Another way of extending PML schema without touching the data is when you have something, some value which did not contain any structural information, and you suddenly want to add some structural information to the value, and container is the data type that is particularly designed for this, that you can attach annotation to values that were previously unstructured. And again, the data files may remain untouched. The annotation files that you have already created may be untouched. When you create variants of PML schemas, the best way to do it is to use modularization support in PML. First of all, every PML schema can be assigned a revision number that you can refer to from other PML schemas. You can steal type declarations from external PML schemas and copy them into your own PML schema, but you do not have to do that in a text editor by copy and paste. You simply can write this import instruction, which indicates which schema a particular type should be taken from and copied into your schema. And at the same time, it copies also all data types that were referred to by this declaration, by the declaration of lexitem type. You can also start a complete PML schema by copying everything from an existing schema, and you can also specify a certain revision of that schema, and then you can extend this schema by further declarations. Sometimes, when you copy a data type declaration from one schema into your own schema, you have to extend it or reduce it, and that's why we have a derive instruction in PML schema language, which allows you to take an existing data type declaration rename it if you want to, and extend it or prune it. So you can either so you can add new, for example, add new members to an existing structure, or delete some members that already exist, that existed in the previous declaration. So basically, what this instruction does is that it takes the declaration of lexitem, which is a structure, and creates a new declaration named phrase lexitem, and replaces the declaration of the member named word with the declaration of a new member named phrase, which carries C data formatted as arbitrary string. These instructions, import and derive, they are pretty straightforward to implement in application, but some languages like XSLT are not really suitable for working with multiple documents. So if you want to process your PML schema through an XSLT and you want all these important derived instructions resolved, then because this is not easily implemented to be implemented in XSLT, you probably should use this tool, which takes your schema and resolves all these instructions and creates a schema which is semantically equivalent but does not contain these instructions anymore. And that schema you can process with XSLT. This diagram shows how you validate data in PML. So let's say that you have a PML-based format which is described by this PML schema, which also includes some data types from this PML schema. And so first thing you should do is to check that these two PML schemas are actually valid. So you validate the schemas first, and we have a RelaxNG grammar for them. So you can check that your schemas are correct, and if they are, you simplify them and create one simplified schema. That means that all the include instructions are resolved. And then you take this simplified schema, you process it with XSLT, with this XSLT style sheet that is available on the website, and create a RelaxNG grammar, which is a file that is particularly suitable for validating XML data, and you use some conventional tools to validate the instances using this grammar. All these tasks can be automated. We have a script called Validate PML, which does what is shown on the picture for you. You simply feed the data to it. You may ask why we chosen RelaxNG. And we also have some schematron instructions in it for validating PML and not DTDs or W3C schema. Let's just say that W3C schemas do not allow us to describe a complex structure in XML that well as RelaxNG can. Okay, let's have a look how PDT layers are encoded in PML. So here you recognize the four layers of annotation on PDT, and we have one PML schema for every annotation layer. As you see, the annotations are interconnected by links, which are ID-based in all four cases. And where it is possible, we use the role knit to allow embedding the lower layers into the upper layers. So actually, these three layers can be merged into one single data representation if we want to, using the knit relation. So we have these four schema files for these four layers. Now we may look in more detail how the analytical layer is represented in PML. So every analytical layer file in PML starts with a mandatory header which indicates the schema for the file, and then it contains some metadata about the annotation, which are usually pretty useless anyway. But the important part of the analytical layer file is the list of the trees. Each of the trees is represented by its root node, and there are two types of nodes in the trees: these root nodes and all other nodes. Which the root nodes are of a PML type A root type, and the other nodes are of type A node type. I will show you the declarations later. Each of these nodes carries the following members: a member named ort, which carries an integer number that provides a total ordering of the tree. It carries a member named children, which comprises of a list of its child nodes, and it also contains a pointer to the morphological layer, which is suitable for embedding, so it's marked with a role knit. Every node, including the technical root node, carries an analytical function, which is in the PML schema for the root node constantly assigned as aux s. We wished that every node, or for traditional reason, we have also analytical function on the root node, so we can do that by declaring it constantly aux s on the root. And the values of analytical functions are of some enumerated type for the rest of the nodes. And there are some other members that indicate coordination and opposition, membership and parentheses. The tectogrammatical trees, the tectogrammatical files, are very similar to the analytical files. Only every node in the tectogrammatical file carries much more members, and there are some extra relational stuff like coreference and quotation sets in it, but basically the structure is the same. This is a part, the first part of the PML schema for the analytical layer. You see that the PML schema borrows some types from the some data types from the morphological schema. This is because when you embed the morphological layer into the analytical layer via following the knit role, then the data structures from the morphological layer actually appear on the analytical layer. So you have to the types have to be declared in the analytical layer schema. And now there is a declaration for the root element of the XML file. You know, XML documents must be contained in a single element, so you have to declare it, and we do it this way. So we say that the element will be named ADATA, and it will contain a content that is of type ADATA type. The declaration of this type is here, and it is a structure with two members. The first member carries the metadata of the file, and the other named trees carries the trees. Basically, what we have in the AMATA type is version info and description for particular part of annotation. We do not actually use it much. I think that in PDT files, that's actually only written that it is manual annotation, and that's all. This is the declaration of the root node structure. The role node indicates that it is a node, so that the application knows that it should eventually form a tree out of these structures. It carries a member named ID, uniquely identifying the node within at least the file, but actually, in case of PDT, within the whole corpora. It carries a reference to the morphological layer, particularly to a sentence structure on the morphological layer. It carries an analytical function, which is constantly aux s for the root node. It carries the ordering attribute, and it carries a list of child nodes, which are of type A node type. And the list is ordered. The A node type declaration looks like this. It is very similar. It also has the role node. It has an ID. It carries a pointer to the lower morphological layer, which at this point is marked with the role nit. So it means that this member can be replaced with the content of the morphological layer. The annotation, the analytical functions are of some type, which is declared later in the schema. I will not show that. It is enumerated data type, which lists all the analytical functions. And there are two Boolean members, isMember and isParenthesisRoot, used for coordination and parenthesis annotation. There's the ordering attribute ort and a list of child nodes as well here. And here is an example of an instance. This is the actual file. This is a data file. So you see that every PML file starts with a root element that is declared in the PML schema, and everything in the file has a dedicated namespace for PML, which is this string. Every PML file has to have a mandatory header, which indicates the PML schema to be applied to that file, which is this tag. And if the PML instance refers to other files, then you can label these files with shortcuts, with unique short unique identifiers, like we do here with M and W. This is the metadata section, and it is followed by the trees section, which is, as you see, it is a list, uses this LM reserve tag, and every element here is a root node of a tree. Here it how it looks. So this is one of these LM tags, and it carries the ordering and all the members that we saw in the declaration, and one of them is this children member, and this children member carries a list of the children, etc. This is how the tree actually looks, the tree that is encoded in this way in PML. And this is how the representation in XML relates to this graphical representation of the tree. If we look also on the morphological layer, we can extract the actual words, the actual word forms for the nodes that are in the tree by following the links that interconnect these two layers. And finally, since the morphological layer relates to the word layer, we can also extract the original form that was actually in the file. The form that appears in the morphological layer can be corrected if there was a typo in the original text. When these three layers are merged into one, the data structure looks like this. The m.rf reference to the morphological layer is replaced by the structure by the morphological structure that it referred to. And the same happens below on the reference to the word layer. The reference was replaced by the actual data taken from the word layer. There are some technical issues that might be annoying for the end users. most remarkable one is that the files are not copy safe. As you saw, we have four files for each document, and these files refer to one another. And that means that if you rename one of the files, you have to go into the other four files, or at least to those that refer to this file, and change the name there as well, which is technically challenging. And the same happens when you compress the data file. We distribute the data compressed using gzip, and it automatically adds this suffix to every file name. And we have this suffix also inside the file, so whenever you decompress it, you have to edit the files and rename and change and remove the suffix, which is also annoying. Now, I will tell you briefly what we plan to add to PML in the short future. Sometimes there are existing XML vocabulary that are well suitable for representing some particular data, and there's no reason to re-encode this information into PML. So the best approach is to adopt the external vocabulary. So we want to allow a PML schema to indicate that some particular part of data is XML in some other XML vocabulary. As you saw, we do not have much metadata in PDT, but people who work with large corpora usually do have much metadata in their files, and there are existing schemes for representing metadata, and we want to adopt them so that they can be intermixed in or included in PML. Sometimes it is useful to type comments into the PML schema, and these comments might be either informal but might be also formal, might be helpful for application that present the data to the user. For example, with every possible value of an analytical function, you could add a description string into the PML schema so that the application could take it and present it as a hint to the user. And so what we need is some form of annotation of the schema. W3 schema has it, and I think the same could be applied to PML. We will in the near future extend the set of roles, because we plan to use PML for representation of lexicons, and here are some relational roles that come to one's mind when he thinks about representing lexicons in PML. I already mentioned that we only have ID-based links, and there are many more ways to link, to relate data, and that means that we need more types of links in PML. And probably the best most ambitious plan is to create tools that read PML schema file and automatically generate code that reads the instances, that provides API for applications that wish to work with these instances, and then can save the modified instances back. And on the last slide, you can see the homepage of the project that develops the format named PML. You can find the specification of PML there. You can find all the files that are referred to. These are the grammar files for PML schemas. And you can also find the tools that work with PML in there. I should also mention that PML is supported by TRET. It is actually currently the internal format that TRET uses to represent its data. So if you wish to use TRET and apply TRET on your data, the best way to do it is to translate your data into PML, but I do not force you to represent your entire corpora or your entire tree banks in PML. You simply have to create an XSLT style sheet that you give to Thread, and Thread reads your XML files in whatever format they are and translates them into PML internally.